Counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready. As counsel are getting ready, I will call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. That is case number A22-1302, Helen Kororlek, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that name. I'll be happy to be corrected. Versus the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services and Anoka County. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I know that counsel's
You're right. I forgot to repeat my explanation. You may take your pick. The middle one is the one we have used for a long time. The other ones were set up during the COVID era. You may take your pick. The first one, the middle one, has the light system. It also has a button where you can adjust the height of the lectern if you wish. It's on the front edge of the, down below, the front edge of the surface. No, I'm sorry, it's, if you're looking for the button adjusting the whole structure is there we go.
Oh.
If you wish. If you wish.
It's always been just right.
Yeah, okay, excellent. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Minnesota history.
Could you please introduce yourself and your client before you begin?
My name is Steve Hikens, and my client is Helen Kororlek. The history of Minnesota law has separated the functions of service and filing. It's been a successful tradition that has allowed the parties to work things out without formally involving the court. There are times it's necessary to formally involve the court. In this case, the matter had been in the department's hands for almost 2 years, and they had issued an order. So we decided to invoke the court's jurisdiction under Minnesota Statute 256-045, Subdivision 7, which says, by serving the notice of appeal on the commissioner and the adverse parties. And we did that in this case. The court subsequently decided to dismiss the case because we had not filed it within 30 days. And that's the essence of the appeal here. We assert that the plain language of the statute says the 30 days is tied to the service aspect. It is not tied to the filing aspect. There are many statutes in Minnesota where they are. Very clearly it says within 30 days you must file and you must serve. This is not one of them. The Minnesota Supreme Court in a number of cases has ruled that, in the Midway case in particular, that you couldn't transfer the dates from one section to another section. And this court in the VNR case ruled that you could not transfer the dates from one subpart to another subpart. And yet here, the court simply took the 3 weeks, or the 30-day standard, moved it from service and added it to filing. And that's what we assert was the error. Because Minnesota law has, for 150 years, been based on service commenced by serving. I mean, a commencement of a lawsuit is commenced by serving.
Counsel,
not by filing.
If I could.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So Minnesota certainly has some tradition of separating service from filing, and I think you're specifically probably referring to filing of a complaint.
Yes.
Right, in a civil action. Right.
Correct.
Okay. This isn't filing a complaint in a civil action, right? This is commencing an appeal from the commissioner's decision.
Using the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure.
Well, in part, but it's controlled by statute.
Yes,
right?
It is.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate your comments about importing the 30-day deadline, but I'd like you to address, if you could, the district court's concern, which I think is fairly directly stated in paragraph 8 on page 4, as being that neither the statute nor the rules of civil procedure do not allow the notice and proof of service to be filed with the court administrator at the appellant's convenience. I think that's the concern that the district court saw.
I agree. That's her concern.
Because it seems as though your position is asking us to say, well, there's no deadline ever for filing.
Well, looking at the history of Minnesota.
If you don't mind if I just complete the question here.
Right.
That's all right. And I know you know exactly what I mean, so I appreciate that. That the district court's concern is that there's no deadline. Now, under your reading of the statute, there's no deadline for filing.
There's no official deadline, but there are incentive on both parts. The argument presented by the respondent was that only the county can act efficiently because it has its goals in mind, which are to find out, is this case over? Can they give notice that, to the appellees, that in that context, that it's done? We're saying that there's self-interest on the part of the persons who are aggrieved here to also have matters resolved. They're portrayed as procrastinators. That is simply not true. I'm sure there are some. I'm not going to question that.
Well, the reason I ask, right, is that the impact of no deadline is because the premise of your beginning argument is that there's a reason for Minnesota allowing pocket service of a civil complaint. You alluded to it. It's to allow settlement of a case.
That's correct.
Is that what happens here?
No.
Where there's a commissioner's decision finding maltreatment like this, and there's merely the service of the notice of appeal without the filing? I mean, there isn't a settlement, is there? Is that even a practical argument?
We didn't know at the time. When we filed it, when we served it, it was the idea of, here's a deadline, it's 30 days, you have to do it. Then the next step was 2 weeks later requesting a transcript. The transcript specifically says you must request the transcript within 30 days of the service of the notice of appeal. It doesn't say a single word about filing. It says within 30 days of notice. It's about two sentences below the one that's in dispute primarily. But the legislature specifically circled that time frame and saying you have to request a transcript by that time. So that was the next step. Until I had transcript, I was not part of the underlying case, Your Honor. So I had to get the transcript to read 19 days or whatever it was to get a feel for what the case was. And so I couldn't know at that point whether or not there was a possibility of settlement. I think we finally got the transcript about 6 weeks later. So we're about 2 months into it now. And then, unfortunately, other personal reasons, my son's health, I couldn't focus on this case. And so the next thing we got was a court's order that's saying, here's the time frame. That's fine. We didn't argue about that. We accepted that. Then 2 months after that, I get a letter from the county attorney saying they're moving to dismiss because it wasn't filed in time. So there was not any attempted settlement during that time except an evaluation of whether there might be settlement. Now, I grant, the county may be totally opposed to it. I didn't know. But I didn't have a feel for what the facts were until I got the transcript. And that was conditioned on service. Okay. Historically, the reason I bring this up is because it has worked in Minnesota to many, many cases to have them resolved without filing in court. Now, a couple of years ago, the court system decided to add Rule 5.04, which says you have to decide them you have to file them within a year. So there is now an outer boundary. But the normal boundary is the self-incentive of a person in Helen Karolik's position who wants to find work. Well, under the existing statement, it would be very difficult to find work, much even volunteer jobs. Perhaps impossible. So she has an incentive to clear that as much as she can, and if the county will agree to some kind of reasonable settlement, that would be very workable. February 1st, while all this is going on, as I just mentioned, just before I get the notice from the lawyer about dismissal, the ward, Olga Korolik, died. And so that became a shift, and the focus was on her death and matters related to that. So when I did file papers, I specifically said, since the ward has died, one of the things we'd like the court to consider is modifying or rescinding the order, the commissioner's order, to reflect that it no longer doesn't apply to her because she's no longer alive. And so That was another opportunity for settle, but it didn't happen. But if Minnesota has a tradition, it is focused on settlement, now Rule 5.04, which has the outer limits. But in all cases, what usually drives settlement is the self-incentive of the parties, whatever that is. I mean, the way the respondent portrayed all these people are automatically bad people. They're automatically procrastinators. They'll never do anything. And the judge seemed to accept that same notion, that it would be at the convenience of the parties. I would say, if you qualify that to at the self-interest of the parties, I would agree with it. The question is, when does that self-interest manifest itself as convenience? Well, I'm sure there are many cases where somebody has said, I'm not in any hurry to do this. I want to take my time. But that's been true for all of Minnesota law.
And so now, in this case, if the court focuses more on the self-interest of the parties as being what drives the filing of the notice of appeal of this sort of decision, it seems to me that what you're inferring or implying is that, and you alluded to it already, so someone in, and am I saying it correctly, is it Ms. Kolarik?
Kolarik,
okay. So Ms. Kolarik would be unable to work. So the maltreatment determination remains after service of the notice of appeal. It is binding and is in effect,
yes,
right?
But
until
if you wait one more day, day 31, it'd be too late to even challenge it.
Correct, right.
Or to negotiate a settlement because there's no interest in settling once the case is over. But see, I don't know of anything that prohibits the county from filing the notice of appeal that they received. In other civil actions, the defendant can file the complaint and start the clock rolling. I'm not certain there's one way or the other. I don't do a lot of administrative law. But it seems to me that they would have that same option, that they could start the clock by filing, because that was their concern. They had no leverage.
Well, counsel, you know, subdivision 7 does place some burdens on a party who is aggrieved, right?
Right.
By the order of the commissioner. And, you know, I'm skipping a lot of words here, but may appeal the decision, may appeal to the district court by serving and then by filing. So it does seem to me, at least one reading of that subdivision, is that the party aggrieved has to take two steps. It's not satisfied by the county taking a step.
No, and I agree. Okay. Filing does appear to be required. There just isn't a time limit imposed, and that's consistent with Minnesota law.
So if I can jump in here, because I want to make sure I understand. You're not saying that the statute's ambiguous at all?
No.
Right. And the subject of both of those requirements is the same, in your view. It's the aggrieved party is the subject of that sentence. They are the
yes.
one doing the serving. They're the one doing the filing, to get back to Judge Bratbold's question.
Correct.
Okay.
And I'm saying that the filing may well be a requirement, but it doesn't have a time limitation.
And, right. And I understand that argument as well, that the specific 30 days is, you know, if we could go back to the days of grade school or whatever we were diagramming sentences, I understand the argument here that there's a comma and then the word and then an independent clause regarding filing. And, you know, the grammar of that statute, I understand why you would argue that that is a separate provision.
I wrestled with that phrase and because I didn't know quite how to interpret it. That's where I ultimately came down. It's saying it's a requirement, just the timeline doesn't apply. But Minnesota, interesting, a few years ago there was a case, Lemertson, where this Court of Appeals ruled that the word and was both conjunctive and disjunctive. And then it's 638 Northwest 2nd 494. Supreme Court reversed, saying it was all conjunctive, but it was a law firm disqualification case. And they wrestled with the concept of how does and apply. And that's part of where I got the idea that it makes sense that it's saying it's a requirement, but not a time limitation. The Wong case, and I appreciate counsel bringing that up. I frankly was not aware of the Wong decision in the Eighth Circuit on this very statute that we're talking about. And you know, they were very professional and brought it up and presented it. It looks at this same language and it says the plain language of this statute is 30 days applies only to service. Then the court went on and said, to the extent there's any ambiguity, we would apply the concept of last antecedent, which says there's a time-limiting phrase like 30 days. Where does it apply to? It goes back to the noun or phrase before it. It doesn't go forward to the phrase about filing. It goes backwards. And Minnesota has adopted that same concept in a couple of other cases that are cited in their brief, Woodhall and I don't remember the other one right now. But that court went on to say, look, when you apply last antecedent to the phrase that's otherwise viewed as ambiguous, the outcome is the same. So that's what the Eighth Circuit said in the Wong case, that whether you view it as plain language, which it did, or as ambiguous, comes out the same. Now, neither party here is asserting ambiguity. So unless this court decides that it sees the language as ambiguous, those arguments perhaps don't enhance the evaluation. But the Minnesota is just about the only state that still has hip pocket service. The federal federal system gave it up a long time ago.
Is it necessary for us to refer to the rules of civil procedure in order to resolve your appeal?
I think so, because
to rule in your favor.
It's commencing a civil action in Minnesota is still based on serving of a summons. And so in that sense, yes.
So you want us to interpret both the statute, Subdivision 7, and the rules of civil procedure to reach our result?
Yes, I don't know that you have to, but I think it...
Well, that's my question, whether we must, whether or isn't it sufficient just to look at Subdivision 7?
Because the context is so important in Minnesota interpretations, the context includes the rules of civil procedure. And Rule 3.01, Rule 6.05 have been read specifically in the Reynolds case here in this court to apply to... this Minnesota statute. There are others, but I remember that one specifically, Reynolds, where they say that 6.05, computing the number of days, has to be applied to 250. And when I remember arguing with Judge Murphy, McCarthy, and she didn't think the rules of civil procedure should apply at all, but she ultimately adopted them, saying, okay, she has to recognize that Rule 5 applied, I think, part of Rule 6. She makes specific reference to applying them. But then she ends up saying it may mean service is timely. So I think it's interwoven. The Minnesota system says you read the statutes, and if it's commencing a new action, you read the rules of civil procedure.
Okay. Thank you. Your initial allotment of time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Counsel for respondent, you may... approach, introduce yourself and your client, and begin.
Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Robert Yount, and I represent the County of Anoka as the respondent in today's matter. This court should hold that an aggrieved party who is seeking judicial review of a commissioner's order under 256.045, subdivision 7, must both serve and file notice of appeal within the 30-day jurisdictional deadline. That is the only reasonable interpretation of the statutory text before the court today. That is principally compelled by three major premises that this court should follow in writing its order. The first is that in DFC and Reynolds, this court in two published decisions held that the triggering acts in this subdivision 7 are jurisdictional. That's precedent. Second, in Reynolds, this court squarely held the following, quote, the statutory appeal time remains 30 days. So it is precedent that the statutory time frame in which someone must appeal under subdivision 7 is 30 days. And third, under the Dempsey decision...
In that second case, did we specifically address this provision and the independent clause and the comma and what is it, what the conclusion in Wong essentially?
No, this court did not squarely address that in Reynolds. So the court here today does have a new unresolved question before it. It would be an extension of Reynolds as the respondent's interpretation.
Can I stop you before you go on? I don't see Reynolds in your table of authorities. At least I don't think I do. Is it cited in your brief? Forgive me if I missed it. Well, if not, can you tell me the citation?
Yes, I can. I do believe it's cited in the brief. I can get that to you later. But the citation is 737 Northwest 2nd at 367.
Okay, you may proceed.
So what was the issue in Reynolds, Mr. Yount?
So the issue in Reynolds is whether the Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 6.05 applied. 6.05 is the provision that talks about the 3 extra days for mailing service, about whether that applied to the provisions of 256.045 subdivision 7. The Court of Appeals in a precedential decision held that it did. However, there's 2 significant caveats with Reynolds' application.
Sorry, which statute did it?
The present one before the court today,
okay.
256.045. There are 2 significant caveats to Reynolds that actually support respondents' interpretation. First of all, as the Reynolds court stated, and I can pull the specific quote here, quote, although this case involves a determination by an administrative agency, the rules of civil procedure have been applied beyond the district court arena, including situations involving a state agency. That's relevant to this case because the court recognized that certain select rules of civil procedure can be applied with regard to appeals from administrative agencies. The idea being, perhaps in response to Your Honor's question, Judge Johnson, is that the whole panoply of rules of civil procedure do not apply, only specific ones insofar as they are appropriate. The other limiting principle that's recognized in Reynolds is a citation to the Rules of Civil Procedure 82, which requires that the rules may only be applied and they shall not be construed to extend or limit the jurisdiction of the district courts. So that's the limiting principle with the application of whether certain rules of civil procedure apply. Now, why does that matter here? Because at base, what I think appellant is asking and what is necessary in order for this court to find for appellant is that the rules of civil procedure 3.01 and the governing the service of process, the hip pocket service, and the rule of 6.05, that 1-year limiting time for that hip pocket service, applies to these types of actions.
So if Reynolds was, I think, a 2007 case?
Yes.
Was that discussed by the Eighth Circuit in Wong as having some impact on its analysis?
That may be where that case comes into or comes through into these. Into the case.
I'm asking you, if you don't know, that's fine, you don't know, we can look it up. But I'm wondering what Wong said about your argument that somehow Reynolds impacts or precludes us from reaching the conclusion that the Eighth Circuit did in Wong.
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood
your arguing, question. It sounds like, that Reynolds somehow limits our interpretation here and essentially precludes us from concluding what the Eighth Circuit did in Wong. So I'm wondering then, what did the Eighth Circuit say about this case that seems to be at odds with their own analysis? And if they didn't say anything, why is Wong wrong based on Reynolds?
And I actually practiced that in front of the mirror, Your Honor. Wong is wrong. But let me answer Your Honor's question. So what the Eighth Circuit did incorrectly is that it equated these types of actions under Subdivision 7 to commencement of lawsuits in Minnesota law. And that's the original error in the Wong decision. They just arrived at that conclusion. They essentially made the argument that appellant is making here, that Minnesota has a storied history of this anomalous hip pocket service for the commencement of lawsuits. But going back to Judge Bradfold's point is that this is a different kind of action from commencement of a civil lawsuit. That's respondent's position, which is why Wong was wrongly decided. Because in these types of cases, there's no civil complaint served. There's no answer served, for instance. There's no summons served, as would be traditional with all types of commencement of civil lawsuits. And that's the distinction here, is that the posture of these cases under 256.045 subdivision 7 is one of an appeal. It's titled judicial review. It's you're reviewing a lower tribunal's decision. And that's the distinction here, because in Minnesota, coherent throughout Minnesota case law, is that in order to establish appeal, you must have personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction. You got to serve the opposing party or adverse party, and you got to file it in the court of jurisdiction. And generally speaking, those are tied together at the same time. With all civil appeals under Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 103.01, they have to be done at the same exact time because they're bound by a single date.
So, counsel, if I agreed with you that the Eighth Circuit, the majority opinion in Wong, kind of took a misstep when it equated the appeals filed under Subdivision 7 to a civil complaint, would I have to necessarily disagree with the other conclusion in Wong, which is to read the plain language of the statute, Subdivision 7, as requiring service only within the 30-day period? So that's the first part of Wong, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Wong initially stated, the majority opinion in Wong stated that the plain language of the statute supported that interpretation.
So even if I agree with you on that, as I said, the majority got it wrong when they tried to equate, when they did equate, or at least gave some reasoning. Let's put it that way. I think that's what they say. The majority, they say, well, there's a sort of a reason to separate service from filing. We can look at Minnesota's history, as we heard appellant argue. So kind of by analogy more than anything. But even if we don't like that analogy, I mean, what do we do with the plain text of Subdivision 7? Because that's really what compelled the majority in Wong. Again, not binding on this court, but perhaps persuasive.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. And so that was actually the third point and the third major premise that I wanted to get to for this court, and that really ties it all together, is that in the Dempsey decision, and I would say implicitly reaffirmed in the matter of V&J Farm decision from this court, is that it is textually significant when the legislature includes two triggering acts in the same sentence. So in Dempsey, the Supreme Court in 1960 held that because the legislature included two triggering acts in one sentence, that they must both be jurisdictional or neither are jurisdictional. That analysis holds true here because there are two triggering acts that have been held by this court to be jurisdictional. And then in Matter in V&J, this court noted that when the legislature wants to decouple two triggering acts to establish jurisdiction, it knows how to do that. It puts it into two different subparts or two different subdivisions of a statute. That's how the legislature indicates.
Are you arguing the statute's ambiguous?
We take the position that the statute is unambiguous. However, I can see that there are two reasonable interpretations before the court and that the decision in Wong is fractured. And so this court would stand on solid grounds if it believed that it was unambiguous.
So the text of Subdivision 7 says a party may appeal by doing two things, by serving, dot, 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 and by filing, dot, dot, dot. So only the first part of that two-part requirement has the phrase within 30 days after, dot, dot, dot. And so it comes after the words by serving something, and then in the second part after the and, by filing, there's no time limitation at all. Why is it inappropriate to say that the within 30 days modifies only the first part of that long sentence, the by serving part, and does not modify the by filing part?
Yes, Your Honor, because it leads to one of two inescapably, I would say, absurd results. For instance, and that's essentially what appellant is asking this court to hold, right, is that that modifying phrase only modifies the immediately preceding subject and not the second independent clause. That's the rub here. But that would lead to an absurd result because either that means that appellant believes that the act of filing the notice of appeal in district court is not jurisdictional, in that it's not necessary to establish jurisdiction. I would say that is not supported by the DFC or Reynolds decisions. And I would also say that he may have conceded that on appeal. He used language saying that it may be required to establish jurisdiction. I'm not quite sure what appellant's position on, but the point is that that would have to be one of their positions, or they would have to say that they can indefinitely file it in district court at any time that they want. And that was goes back to Judge Bradfield's decision, is that that would be anomalous with how Minnesota treats appeals of lower tribunals. And keep in mind, the purpose of 256.045 is to establish a streamlined way for aggrieved parties like Ms. Korolek to challenge the maltreatment determinations, right? This is an administrative, streamlined fashion that also includes a streamlined appeal to the district court, again, with a very narrow review.
How are you, your client, disadvantaged by, I mean, let's take a scenario where a party serves and then doesn't file for a period of, a month or two. That's this case. Let's say 3 months.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask about this case. How were you disadvantaged in this case by, maybe it was more like 2 weeks, I don't know. How were you disadvantaged in this case by that two-week interval in which there was a service but there was no filing?
And that's an absolutely fair question, Your Honor, and in concretely, in no way.
And what about if it were 3 months? How would that disadvantage the county?
Again, as I sit here today, I don't exactly know how that would concretely disadvantage the county.
Yeah,
but
go ahead. Yeah, please.
I think where Your Honor is going with this is that as it gets further and further out, that just injects uncertainty into the finality of the case.
I was going to let you do that.
explain to me why it injects uncertainty. Because as was acknowledged by appellant's counsel, the commissioner's decision is binding and conclusive until reversed, right?
Well, with a caveat, under subdivision 5 of 256.045, it states that the decision is not conclusive, but it is effectual. So the commissioner may act in accordance with the order, but the order is not deemed to be conclusive.
I'm sorry. Can I stop you there if Judge Bradfield doesn't mind? Somebody had cited in their brief subdivision 3b with no parens, paren C and paren, which says, I'm sorry, I got the wrong. I'm struggling now to find the right subdivision. But I thought there was another statute that said that it is conclusive. And so you're telling me there's another. Can you tell me about these two different statutes that say seemingly different things? It's conclusive, it's not inclusive.
And just be clear where you are. Subdivision.
And there's multiple paragraphs of subdivision 5 as well.
Yes. It is not a model of clarity, Your Honor. Subdivision 5 of statute 256.045 talks about, it does, I would say, actually, it has a, I don't really know how to square these two circles, but what it says is that the order is not deemed conclusive unless they appeal under subdivision 7. But then the next sentence is that it may, however, be acted upon or it's effective. So similar to a traditional summary judgment order.
Can I stop you now? So yeah, 3BD says it is conclusive unless appeal is taken in the manner provided in subdivision 7.
Yes.
So to me, that indicates if somebody has only done one of the two things that are required, the appeal is not yet taken pursuant to sub 7, still is conclusive. Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt your argument, but
no, absolutely not, Your Honor. So, just to finish my thought there, just I think in response to your question is that similar to how a summary judgment order at the district court becomes effectual, even while it's pending appeal, unless you seek a motion to stay. That's what I think the analog here is with here. But again, the law prefers finality, and also I want to draw back again. See the forest instead of the trees. Is that we're talking about judicial review, specifically when you're on a posture of appeal. You want finality, and you want to know if this case is going on to the next court of appeal for review. And that is really what the question presented to the court is today, is this more similar to the commencement of a lawsuit, like the Wong decision held and like appellant is asking for, or is it more similar to an appeal? Respondent's position, it is not similar to a commencement of a lawsuit. There's no complaint, there's no answer, there's no summons. And pulling at those rules of civil procedure addressing those would be inapplicable and unnecessary. Therefore, the respondent asks that you affirm the lower court's decision.
Judge Johnson.
Go ahead, Judge Bradfield.
Yep. So one question. Do you have the language of subdivision 5 in front of you?
I don't believe I do, Your Honor. Okay. I apologize for that. But
No, that's fine. And do you happen to remember? I mean, it is very long. So
it is.
Paragraphs. Do you remember which paragraph you rely on?
In subdivision 5?
Yeah. And if you don't, I understand. I'll certainly.
If I remember, there are 3 or 4 paragraphs in subdivision 5, and it might be paragraph 2 or 3.
Okay.
I apologize. I don't have the full text in front of me.
Appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Yao.
Thank you.
Mr. Hykens, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to mention that because both sides are claiming plain language, this court has to determine if one interpretation is reasonable and the other is not, or if both are reasonable, then you go to the ambiguity route. But we assert that ours is more reasonable because it does tie into the history of Minnesota, that the legislature knows when it's writing its laws. When it prepared Subdivision 7, it was fully aware of Minnesota's history. And that, I'd also like to add the Skyline decision, 835 Northwest 2nd, 472, is one of the times where the Supreme Court said there's a difference between ongoing transactions, like Board of Adjustment, and starting a lawsuit, which is just, it's very similar to a notice of appeal like this one, where it shifted gears to the commencement of a civil action which invoked the rules of civil procedure. And that the commission seems to look primarily to APA for its guidance and try to fit within the administrative code, in particular statutes 14.63 and 14.64. That's the very one that the Supreme Court in Midway said, we're not going to take and import the number 30 days from one statute into the next one. And that's why I believe that it's the judiciary has taken a fairly firm line on changing what the legislature said.
So if I can jump in on that point, because I am reading from Reynolds as directed during Mr. Yount's argument, and it, you know, the quote that he gave us, the statutory appeal time remains 30 days, seems to suggest something more than service has to happen within 30 days.
And because of the words, the appeal time?
Interpreting this very subdivision, 256.045 subdivision 7, the Reynolds court says, quote, the statutory appeal time remains 30 days.
Well, that would be true whether our interpretation is correct or their interpretation. You know, our interpretation is once you've served the summons or the notice of appeal, you've invoked the jurisdiction. So, I mean, I'm missing something. I apologize.
So, normally, when we're looking at an appeal, it's important to look at when the appeal was filed as well.
Well, certainly. If you're in the appeals court, you can't start a lawsuit in the Court of Appeals, like this one, unless you both serve and file within 60 days.
And in Reynolds, we stated the time for appeal is 30 days. Not 60, but 30.
Right, but the question is, when is the appeal? I'm saying the appeal is when the notice of appeal has been served. That's what I'm saying. The Reynolds court did not say contradictory that. It said the time period for appeal. I'm saying that our interpretation of the statute is that appeal is when you serve the notice of appeal. You know, there's another part that hasn't come up here, and that's our request for a hearing in this particular case. The statute says a party may obtain a hearing upon notice and request. And we did that, but the court still denied it. Now, understandably, when she dismissed this for her other interpretation, this came along with it. But we just like to make sure that's part of the court's conscious awareness.
And am I correct in assuming that we don't get to the second issue unless we find in your favor on the first issue?
That's probably true, yes. You know, I didn't do any search of how many statutes use 30 days for both. There are several. Counsel pointed out several cases where the legislature wrote you have to serve it within 30 days and then you have another 10 days to file it or another 30 days to file it. They are aware of what they're doing. They know how to separate these two concepts. And in B&J, they were very specific about that, saying the legislature knows how to separate service and filing. And reading the wording and the plain language in this statute, that's the most reasonable interpretation, is that the legislature intended to separate those two things, whether for purposes of appeal, as Your Honor said, or for purposes of clarity and going forwards and providing opportunities for the parties to work things out.
Mr. Hykens, what happens if a party serves and then a let's say a year later, nothing else has happened. There's been no filing.
Under 5.04, dismissed with prejudice. I mean, that's the one major change. We went from no deadlines to, in some counties, had six-year deadlines, and now we're all at one-year deadlines. So it's just, it's over. It's automatically over.
And that is, so you're saying that applies to this type
absolutely,
of...
Absolutely, yes. You know, and I think the main difference, though, still, do the parties have a self-interest that can be addressed outside of the court formal setting by virtue of serving and proceeding in that fashion? Or do we have to be formally filed with court in order to have any forward movement? In this case, there was a lot of momentum that were driving this case, and we wanted an independent judge to look at the same set of facts and evaluate how another set of eyes, because the momentum of the department was going very strong, and this was an opportunity to have an independent judge look at it and say, the financing wasn't done here for the hoarding, the so-called removal of the hoarding. Why wasn't that addressed in the court of decision? I'm sorry.
I'm just pointing out your
My light's flashing.
Yeah, your time has expired.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hykens. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.